Here we are. This is Wednesday, what, February 17th, 2010. Okay. And we're going to talk tonight about the awakened.
There's a ladybug on that.
Oh, where?
Right on the paper.
Okay. My kangaroo moment here. So I printed up 45 of these. I think we have a few more people here than that. So feel free to pass one and maybe share with your neighbor, what have you. This is a page or a saying, a teaching from the Buddha that some of you have seen before, if you've been here before. We are this year working with the general theme of mindfulness in here, and in particular, working with the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness contained in what he called were the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four establishings or establishments of mindfulness. In other words, that which we are to be mindful of. And this particular piece of paper that I'm passing around is the preamble, really, that sets up how one is to be for each of those four foundations. And actually, this time, I think I'll just simply, thanks, Sundara, I'll just read it just in the interest of time here. The Buddha here is addressing monks, but really, he's addressing everyone, because in the Buddhist frame, enlightenment, awakening, the end of suffering, unshakable peace and happiness is the birthright of everyone and is the opportunity that's available to everyone if we earn it, right? So here he is talking about what he called the one-way path, the direct path to liberation from suffering. It isn't the only path. Sometimes that word is mistranslated, and modern scholars have clarified that the four foundations of mindfulness are not the only path to liberation, but they are a sufficient path, and they are a direct and one-way path to liberation. So he's saying that if we walk that path, if we do that work in our daily life, through thick and thin, whether it's a ladybug or a kangaroo, or our partner, you know, giving us that look, or a letter from the IRS, or someone we don't like talking on Fox News, whatever it is, right? Whatever it is, no parking place, you know, a waiter that's slow, coffee that's cold, whatever it is that we practice mindfulness with that event, and in particular our reactions to that event. So how are we to take that path? How are we to engage this process in our own lives of moving in a direct and irrevocable one-way way toward the end of suffering? The Buddha lays out a very clear set of instructions as a general attitude and orientation. And tonight I want to talk about one particular phrase in here and use that as a way to talk about the nature of the awakened brain. So he says, here, people, in regard to the body, or in regard to the feeling tone of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that's the second foundation of mindfulness. The first one is the body. So in regard to the body, or in regard to the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or in regard to the state of mind as either wholesome or unwholesome, kind of altogether, or in regard to fourth foundation, major topics like the Four Noble Truths. In regard to all of those, one should abide contemplating them, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Now, we've spent some time in here unpacking what it means to contemplate and to be diligent and to be clearly knowing. Linda talked some about being mindful. I suspect Gay will do much the same. I'll come back and focus some on mindfulness as well, particularly in terms of how your brain, my brain, is mindful or not. But today I want to talk a little bit about what it really means to abide free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Okay? Because it is desires and discontent that make us suffer. So finding a way to be free of desires and discontent, or relatively free, more free, freer, is a path to what our heart truly yearns for. So first of all, of the world. And one way to relate to the language here is first with some skepticism. As the Buddha said himself, see for yourself what really makes sense for you. And second, frankly, as a kind of roadmap or operating manual. I mean, for better or worse, without a doubt, he was an historical figure who was a very serious and accomplished practitioner. I mean, he walked the talk. He did it in his own real life. And he's saying to other people, look, this is what you need to do. I mean, one way to relate to the Buddha is as a coach. He's telling us, this is what works. You do what you want, but this is what I've seen works. And the closer you converge on this standard, the closer you get to this mode of being, the better your path will be, the more fruitful it will be, and the better it will feel. You know, there's an interesting line in Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy. It says essentially at the very beginning of that book, all happy families are alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Isn't that very interesting? And that's a way of getting at something that you can see if you watch the Olympics. In other words, if you watch a bunch of six-year-olds trying to ski down a hillside, there's a lot of variation in how they do it. But as you move up the ranks and people get better and better and better at it, they converge on a standard of excellence. In the same way, the Buddha is offering to us a standard of excellence in our own practice that as we progressively converge upon in how we operate, we become increasingly skillful and our practice becomes increasingly effective. So what could he have meant when he talks about contemplating the world? He's really talking there about the phenomenal world. In other words, the world of our experience, our thoughts, our feelings, our bare apprehension of, you know, the hard stuff out there. Knock on wood, I say as I thump my skull, right? That's what he's talking about when he says the world. So when he says free from desires and free from discontent, he's talking about that with regard to everything we're aware of. Now to the money part, right? The essence of it all. What in the world could it mean to be free from desire and discontent? We have a brain that's the product of 600 million years of the evolution of the nervous system. It's really important and useful to appreciate what a long, strange trip it's been, right, in the Grateful Dead lyric. And for example, primates and mammals are our peeps, our folks, us, been around for around 80 to 100 million years, depending on how those groups are defined. Close relatives who began making stone tools lived in Africa 2.5 million years ago. They had a brain a third our size. The brain has tripled in the last 3 million years, and yet they were able to make, very, very skillfully make, stone tools. Along that long journey, the brain developed desire and discontent to pass on its genes, right? Because being good at desire, in other words, being good at wanting things, and being good at being fearful and cranky, really helped pass on genes in very, very harsh conditions. The brain evolved other capacities as well, you know, to love, and to aspire, and to hope and to dream, and to make sense of this conversation or presentation here tonight, to play chess, to make movies, you know, to throw a football, to ski down a mountainside. But very, very fundamentally, deep within each one of us, are very strong inclinations and capacities toward desire and discontent. Yet simultaneously, without a doubt, in history, thousands and thousands of people in the historical record have attained a mind, and therefore a brain, completely and irrevocably free of any desire or discontent. Operationally, let's say, defined in Buddhism as a mind that is absolutely free of greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? Pleasant and unpleasant experiences may come and go. No being, even the most realized being, is free from old age, disease, and death, or from a heart that hurts when loved ones are lost. That's not possible. But to be free of greed or hatred or delusion, ignorance, in other words, related to everything that life holds, without a doubt, in my view at least, there are many, many examples, known and unknown, of people who've attained that state. And each of us along the way, both in everyday life and in formal practice, have had moments, haven't we all had moments, where the mind is quiet, it comes to a place of balance. And it really isn't activated around greed, hatred, or delusion. It really doesn't have much, if any at all, desire or discontent. What could be going on in the brain in that state of mind? Because every state of mind corresponds to a state of brain. And every state of brain corresponds to a state of mind. They co-arise interdependently in a circular way, right? When the brain changes, the mind changes. When the mind changes, the brain changes. The mind uses the brain to make the mind. Right? So it's very useful to think about what could be going on inside the black box, right? Inside the 3 pounds of tofu, in effect, between the ears, or tapioca pudding, depending on how you think about it. What's going on in there that could support and nourish the mind states that are free from desire and discontent? So I've gotten really interested in answering that question, and I want to offer to you tonight the beginnings of an answer, and then open it up for discussion. And I suggest that the way to relate to what I'm going to talk about tonight is with skepticism and curiosity, not to believe it, and in particular, continually coming back to your own experience. Like, what's it like for me to feel greed or hatred, broadly defined? In other words, to have desire for things, or to resist things. What's that like for me? Alternately, what's it like for me to settle into a feeling of being already full, for example, or at peace with whatever's here, even if it's unpleasant? What's that like for me? Okay. So I have a little piece of paper here. Now, knowing me, as many as you do, I'm really wishing I had a PowerPoint presentation here where I could point to things. I don't. You're lucky for the moment. But I will do it someday. And I've been working on this, so I want to talk about this. So basically, the brain has three fundamental motivational systems. It wants to approach what's pleasant. It wants to resist or avoid what's unpleasant. In other words, it wants to approach the carrots, get the carrots. It wants to get away from the sticks. And it wants to affiliate with us. Right? Approach, avoid, affiliate. Think of those as three fundamental motivational systems. They intertwine. Sometimes one will use the other, one or the other two, toward its ends. Right? But the three fundamental systems. Interestingly, crocodiles and sharks have the approach system and the avoid system, but they're not big on affiliation, right? They have their babies, they swim away, they swim back, it looks like lunch, all right? That's your basic shark or crocodile attitude, like whatever. The black widow spider, you know? First she has sex with them, then she eats them. It's kind of a good reproductive strategy, you know? Calories on the hoof, pass them along to her eggs. Seems to make a lot of sense to the black widow spider, okay? And so, you know, on the other hand, birds and mammals, and then especially primates and especially humans, develop this third system, the system for attachment or affiliation. So all three systems are in play. Now, let's look at the brain of suffering. The brain of suffering, and let's look at, say, the, you know, approaching system that wants the carrots. The brain that's in a state of suffering, right, and has a kind of view of the world as scarcity. There's not enough. That's the brain of suffering with regard to the approach system. And on the basis of that, it wants to grasp and reach. And meanwhile, all the while, there's frustration. Even when there's satisfaction, there's a kind of an embedded anxiety. When will this cookie be gone? When will this thing I want, you know, change? What will I do then? Or will someone come along and take it from me? Right? That's the brain of suffering with regard to the approaching system. With regard to the avoiding system, the brain of suffering, you know, views the world in terms of threat. We are profoundly threat reactive as a species. In a certain kind of sense, we're at the top of the food chain because we're better at dealing with threats than any other species on the planet. And sidebar, I've come to really appreciate how vulnerable you are to feeling threatened, in part by just looking at the news and the media and all the threat messages in the culture and that are almost like wallpaper. We hardly notice them now. You go to the airport, you tune it all out, but Trust me, we're all picking up those subliminal signals. Threat level orange, threat level orange, threat level orange. And I've tried to wake up from that paranoid trance. Most of us, me included, are much more fearful and feel much less safe, you know, than is reasonable. On the other side of it, I've tried to pay a lot more attention about, in the language of the Buddha, give no one cause to fear you. In other words, not be a threat for other people. And to think more about needlessly being threatening when, as I was saying, it's just not necessary. So in the brain of suffering, with regard to the avoid system, the view is threat, okay? Threat from without or threat from within. The action, in many ways, is, you know, fighting or fleeing or freezing and appeasing. You know, the classic stress response behaviors. And the fundamental emotion in there is either fear or anger. That's kind of the nature, right? That's suffering right there. It's not agony, but it's the daily grumble of life, right? That's the kind of suffering that's present there. And then with regard to the, you know, the affiliate system, the brain of suffering there basically has a view of separation, right? Of unavailability, unreliability. And the action there varies. It could be clutching. It could be trying to preserve an optimal distance so there's not too much absorption. Seeking narcissistic supplies. All the grist for the therapeutic mill. And the feeling in it is often of shame. You know, the kind of core emotion is shame, unworthiness, being unwanted. I don't matter. I don't count. Nobody likes me. I don't belong. I've been abandoned. I'll never find love. That's the brain of suffering. So you can see that so far? And I think that, honestly, in a coherent way, encompasses an awful lot of the nature of suffering. So it gets really important to consider how in the world can we cultivate a brain that doesn't suffer with regard to those three systems, that comes to a state of balance. And so, for example, let's go through each one. In terms of the approach system of the brain, a state of non-suffering has an essential quality in it of being already full. Okay? There's already fullness. It doesn't reach out of deficiency. Okay? The fundamental view is of sufficiency. There is enough. There is enough here. There is enough food to go around. There is enough air to breathe. There is enough attention for me to get my own. Whatever it is that I want, there is enough. There is an all rightness. And think about the monks, you know, going forth into homelessness. Basically, a robe, a bowl, food, and medicine. That's their fundamental possessions. The expression. It's very interesting to ask yourself, what's the expression? Because we're not dead. When the brain is awakened, it doesn't just stop. It keeps on going. What's the wholesome expression? The unwholesome expression of the approach system is grasping and clinging, right? What's the wholesome expression? For me, in a word, it's aspiration. It's aspiration. And or to put it a little differently, it's being given over to one's best self, to one's highest callings, to being given over to one's truest, deepest, most sublime, and most wonderful nature. Right? That's the action of the approach system when it's in a state of non-suffering. Because it's still at work. I mean, I think a lot about this. How in the world can you take these brain systems that are designed, right, for greed, hatred, you know, and clinging and all the rest of that, and how do you work with them? I think one way is through this action of, with regard to the approach system, aspiration. And the, so how do we balance it? I think I'm taking a notion here from Tibetan Buddhism to think of the fruit as the path. In other words, the result is also the way we do it. The aim is itself the path. And I think the aim and the path, and it's not the only one, by the way. There are other words that one could come up with for some of these things. But one is gratitude, is the fundamental stance of gratitude, both as the, you know, as to be fulfilled, to to a sublime and complete degree, but also as a method along the way to ease and balance and calm this grasping approach system, to really, really focus on gratitude and the prior sense of being already full. You see the parallels, the contrast, what that is? And this will probably be my book after the next book, right? But it's a big subject, right? It's a big subject, and I'm really happy about kind of collaborating with you in the creation of this notion in a systematic way, because I really do think we need a world where we really have moved beyond, you know, the brain of suffering, and we really move increasingly and clearly toward, you know, the brain of no clinging, you know, the realized brain, the awakened brain. So let's look at the other two systems and then talk about this a bit, okay? Kind of quickly, with regard to the avoid system, what is the, you know, awakened brain like with regard to this intense system? It's probably the most powerful of the three, to avoid the unpleasant, to avoid threats, because those were the things that we really, really needed to pay attention to over the course of evolution. Consequently, we have what scientists call a negativity bias in our brain, right? It's tilted for gene copies, but against quality of life. Or as I put it, the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. What do we do with a brain like that, right? Well, the view, if you will, or the of the awakened brain in this regard is a world that is safe. It feels safe. It doesn't feel full of threats. It feels safe. Bad things may be out there, problematic things may well be out there, but there's a fundamental sense of capacity to deal with them. The action of someone in that mode is restraint. In other words, the wholesome action of the avoiding system, I think, is restraint, which in Buddhism is another word for sila, or virtue, which is one of the three fundamental pillars of practice. In other words, we don't fight our desires, we restrain them. My dad, the kangaroo, he didn't go to war with the kangaroo. He didn't have ill will for the kangaroo. He didn't make up a big story about how the kangaroo was picking on him. And, why are you harassing me? I'm an American. You want to see my passport? He didn't go there, right? What my dad did when the kangaroo was there, he restrained him. You know, he just pushed him away to a comfortable distance. And when that kangaroo had backed up a couple of feet, he was quite happy with him and very benevolent toward that kangaroo. It's an action of restraint. So what's the essence of the avoid system when it's in a state of balance and non-suffering? It's an essence of acceptance. And things are what they are. There is old age, there is disease, there is death, there is emotional pain. There are things that are unpleasant, but instead of fighting them and going to war with them, I accept them as they are. I may then do things about them for myself, because I have goodwill for myself, or for those who I love, but there's a fundamental stance of acceptance. And the aim and the path then, so not so much how does one express the avoid system in a wholesome and non-suffering way, but here I'm talking about how does one attain that state of balance with the same notion of the fruit is the path, you know, the goal, the destination is itself the journey. It's through peace. It's through operating with the world with peace. You know, my dad really, I watched him, he was at peace with the kangaroo. He wanted the kangaroo to back off about 3 feet, but he was at peace with the fact that kangaroo was there. He truly was. It's kind of a trippy moment to watch that little episode there. Right? It's a stance of peace. Right? And then last, kind of quickly, with regard to this affiliating system and attaching system, which Linda, you know, really talked with us about, didn't she, in the last couple of sessions or meetings we've had here, the view of it is of connection. Rather than separation, it's connection. We're already connected. Right? We are all already connected in this room, whether we're aware of it or not. The action that's wholesome of the affiliating system when it's not in a state of suffering is joining. Right? There's a leaning toward. One of my spiritual teachers along the way was Dafri John, Adi Da, and he had a saying that grace leans. Right? It's kind of we lean into presence with ourselves. We lean into presence with what else is here. That's the action, that's the awakened action of that neural system inside the brain. What's its essence? It's anatta. It's not self. It's oneness. It's that sense of interdependence, of that nothing exists or arises entirely on its own. And the aim and the path, you know, how do we, what is the fulfillment, the complete fulfillment of the awakened brain with regard to this system of affiliating? And what also is the journey itself, you know, that carries us along the way? Love. What else could it be? So that is a lot of material fairly quickly, a lot of words. I think the kind of fundamental idea is that we do have these systems. They do go into states of suffering. And they also can be nudged into states of awakening and realization. Ultimately and clearly, with so many examples around us, you know, to a state of complete peace. So what are some of the key ways to do this? Obviously, we're going to be talking a lot more about this, but one of the most fundamental ways is exactly what the Buddha talked about, mindfulness. As soon as we're mindful of the, I'll call it suffering operation, of any one of these three systems, what happens? We start to suffer less. We wrap them with some spaciousness. We get some distance from it. We start having insight into what's going on. We buy ourselves some time to act more skillfully. You know, mindfulness helps us move out of the brain of suffering into the brain of happiness and peace. The other thing it does is it helps us see all these systems as they operate together and to see our personal strengths and weaknesses. So speaking for myself, I grew up in such a way that I was really quite shy and isolated and a complete dork. And very, very young in my schooling as I went through, which added to my sense of isolation, I was very good, I would say, at the approach and the avoid system. But I felt like I was looking at the world through a foot of glass in most of my relationships. And it was only really until I left home and in my 20s and I continue to practice in this area to really work on this capacity for sustaining affiliation. You know, we each have our own issues, right, that we work with. And you might look to yourself, which of these three systems is most often in a state of ease for you, and which is the system that, you know, through mindfulness you can see is the most important one to kind of help move more toward the state of peace and awakening. Okay, that was a lot. Comments or questions? Yeah, please, Julia. Right.
That if I can approach a person asking her, well, how are you experiencing this situation? You know, that, you know, that might be a bridge between us, but also it's not my thinking, oh, she's going to think I'm a horrible person, that she's awful, or whether it might be the whole imagining of that.
Yeah. That's great. I think one way to think about that, so you might have heard what Julia said. Julia said, what do you do if you're if you're dealing in a conflict situation, and one way to deal with it is inquiry, right? Trying to ask questions. What that made me think of is when we're really suffering in one of these systems, to activate the other two. For example, what inquiry does, obviously, is it approaches the other person, and it approaches the problem, the matter at hand, in a not a greedy, grasping, kind of dominating sort of way, but in a wholesome kind of way. And it also activates the affiliating system, because you're kind of joining with the other person. I will say that something that is an area of a lot of science these days, and it's an area that Linda in particular is very knowledgeable about and has been a teacher to me in regard to, is this affiliation system. The affiliation system evolved in part to really balance in the excesses of the approach and avoid systems. And it's a great go-to. And a place to start is to affiliate with oneself. Through what? Mindfulness. Through giving oneself mindful, empathic attunement with compassion and goodwill, right? we're giving to ourselves the kind of affiliation which everybody should receive in life, but many of us have gotten in short supply. Okay, yeah, Linda.
I was trying to map the drama of the eyes for what you're doing here. So it seems that mudita is a way to deal with the...
Translate that.
The sympathetic joy is a way to deal with the basket in that joy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great. Yeah. That's great.
I've been listening to some of the TED Talks online recently, which are a great source of inspirational thinking. And a couple of them were on positive psychology and the brain and so forth. And one of the things that was pointed out was also something that Mark Twain said was that the brain has essentially a great capacity for looking at things and projecting forward or back. I think Mark Twain's comment was, my life has been full of many, I don't know the exact word, but you know,
crises that never happened.
And the brain is very good at imagining scenarios. That was one of the developments that happened in that 3 million years, was the ability for us to make up situations and try and figure out how it would happen. But what goes awry so often for so many people is that we start then imagining all these false scenarios. And that is in the left side of the brain, which deals with the linear thinking of the future and the past. Whereas the right side of the brain is more the gestalt, the here and now, which is the mindfulness, be here now portion of the brain. So the other side of it is, if you can get in your right mind and be present, then a lot of the grasping and aversion, the stories that we make up that makes it bigger, you know, second and third arrows that you talked about, drop away.
That's great. Thank you. All right, others, all the way in the back, yes. Or approach system. Yeah, great question. Well, I think of some classic aspirations in Buddhism, like the Bodhisattva vow. You know, beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Right? Suffering is endless. I vow to end it. You know, the universe is infinite. I vow to encompass it. I mean, like, what? Like, that's an aspiration, right? And it's considered to be a very wholesome aspiration. Or what is the, you know, there's the importance of the aspiration to end suffering, right? For other beings as well as for oneself. And the Buddha was very clear. He said there are many, many good desires, right? So, you know, desire is not the problem. It's clinging to our desires that creates suffering. Desire is just another mental content. That's a really important point. Really important point. Desire is just a mental content. Like a sight, a sound, a sensation, a memory. It's another mental content. The question is, the Dr. Phil question, how's it working for you? You know, what are the fruits? In other words, that's the way the Buddha would put it. You know, what are the fruits? What are the results? Harm or health? And so when I think of aspiration, I think of it as a kind of desire, but a wholesome desire. The term for wholesome desire, if it matters, is chanda, distinct from tanha. Tanha is the desire, the thirst that leads to suffering. It has a lot of clinging and intensity and automaticity in it. But the desire that our children be well, that my dad be happy, that you all, you know, enjoy this and get value and move further in your own path of awakening, those are wholesome desires. So when I feel into the difference between, I think it's possible to have a very passionate and wholesome desire. You know, I think, for example, the passionate desire that your kid finally take a shot in basketball because she's, you know, in fourth grade and deathly afraid of taking a shot in her YMCA basketball team. And so finally you've had to bribe her $1 for every shot she takes. And she finally takes a shot. I think there's no problem with that kind of desire, all right? Or the intense desire that our aging parent get good medical care, right? And there's a place for those things. The problem is when we identify with that desire and cling to it and become intolerant about whether it's fulfilled or not. That's when trouble begins, isn't it? It's not the intensity of the desire. Now, yes, the more intense the desire is, the more we're in a yellow flag condition. But we don't tip over into red until we identify with the desire and attach to it. Isn't that cool? I think it's very important. It's very neat. Now, let's not underestimate the power of passionate desires. I think a lot of people play with fire under the guise of, it's just tantra, dude. You know, glug, glug, glug. Or, you know, fornicate, fornicate, whatever. Yeah, hello? How's that working for you? You know, is that really bringing you closer to enlightenment? So, on the other hand, I think a lot of aspirations, a guiding principle that helps us know that an aspiration is wholesome and generative is how does it actually feel in the body? You know, if we feel contracted and tense and intense and gotta have it, yellow flag, maybe an orange or even a red one. On the other hand, if there's an aspiration that doesn't feel so much like me, it feels like something moving through me, more like a wave that's carrying me along, if there's a kind of spaciousness around it, if there's a non-clinging around it, if there's a sense of being buoyed and uplifted by it and inspired by it, and the unfolding of the expression of that desire and the fulfillment of that desire does well for other people around us, that's got to be a pretty good aspiration. Okay, maybe another person or two, and then we'll move toward that. Yeah, please. If I follow you right, you were kind of thinking out loud there in a lovely way, which is good. And I'm reminded of this phrase that somebody just used to me in passing at Esalen recently, who works there, just a groundskeeper or something. And I was commenting on what a marvelous place Esalen is, having recently been there for the very first time, in my life. And he said essentially, yeah, when you soften and open, da 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 da. And I think what you're talking about is softening and opening rather than hardening and closing. You know? Hard and closed pretty much is a distinguishing characteristic in some fundamental way of the suffering mode of each one of these three systems. Whereas softening and opening is a fundamental characteristic of the more awakened mode of each one of these systems. And when I think about what's involved in art making, the only form of art making I really do is occasionally I'll get a good sentence off. And I also make collages, for my intentions and so forth. And so I have a lot of respect for art making and people who do it. And I think there's got to be some kind of softening and opening to let that flow through you. Well, thank you. I think societies that harden and close to art are societies in trouble. When you look at the hallmark of a totalitarian regime, they shut down the artists as fast as they can. Yeah, I'm asking. Sally. Yeah. Great. Meditation is a subset of mindfulness. And, for example, the Buddha talked about sustaining mindfulness in the four fundamental postures, sitting, lying, standing, and walking. I think, for me, the cutting edge is to sustain mindfulness while speaking. You know, that's interesting to try to do, to sustain a quality of mindfulness while we're speaking. Mindfulness means recollectedness. The root of the word for mindfulness in the early language of Buddhism is sati, and the essence of the word sati is memory, or recollectedness. In other words, we're present to ourselves. We are recollected. We're not just swept along in a state of flow. Flow is great, including artistic flow, or lovemaking flow, or cooking flow. It's really great. But that doesn't necessarily mean we're mindful of what we're doing. Because people are also in flow when they're in a state of rage or violence, right? Or addictive pursuits. That's a state of flow. Why do we make flow so special? Okay. So these three systems operate in various levels, if you will, of suffering or awakening, moment to moment to moment, all the time. And so we need to be mindful of them all the time. That's why I talked about mindfulness. And maybe that's actually a good segue for me to make a final point or two that I wanted to do, and then we'll wrap up tonight. Takeaways here that I nominate for you to consider are, one, to just kind of be awake to, be mindful of these three systems in your own life. Watch yourself, resisting, or I'll just do it in order, watch yourself going after things that look good, and watch whether or not it seems suffering saturated or happiness and love saturated. Okay? Watch yourself resist things that seem unpleasant. And then ask yourself, and is the way I'm going about this saturated with suffering or happiness? And generative of suffering or happiness? And the same with the affiliating or attaching system. You know, am I trying to belong or get close or join or be a part or be loved or approved of or liked or respected and all the rest of that? Am I going about that in a way that generates suffering and is saturated with suffering, or one that leads to happiness and love for myself and others? Okay? Since I started thinking about these three systems a lot, and I did think of them as a triangle, I kind of unconsciously make this gesture sometimes when I talk about these systems. Because really, fundamentally, you can think of there's the suffering version of them, and then there's the awakened version of them. And I'll probably create that figure and put it on a PowerPoint presentation. Just at a workshop near you someday. But anyway, my point about all that is that I have found myself just watching them. I have found myself watching the movement of those three systems. And I have found myself deploying more, trying to relax more in each one, trying to not get so caught up in avoiding and shift more into a state of peace. I mean, the watchwords for me are gratitude, peace, and love. You know, like when, for example, the approaching system gets really revved up. I want. Gratitude is a great antidote. Just grounds it. Grounds it right out, gratitude. Gratitude, already full, everything's sufficient. It's all okay. Right? Good practice. The avoid system, you know, threats, fear, anger. What grounds that out really fast? Safety and peace. And to feel safe, we often have to feel strong. We have to open to our strength. You know, not like I'm going to dominate strength, but the strength my father had to back that kangaroo off, whatever that is. The strength that's taken the Dalai Lama to hang out with the Chinese invasion and keep banging away at the situation there for, 50 years now, starting at age 16. So, that's a kind of peace, a kind of peace and a kind of strength and a kind of safety with the avoid system. And then last, with the affiliation system, when we feel wounded, when we feel like they're not noticing us, when I feel like I'm on the other side of a foot of glass, ignored, cast out, what have you. It's a great practice, both as fruit and path, to drop into a state of love. You know, goodwill, compassion, starting with compassion for oneself, and then moving into, just love and wishing them well and service. I realized a while ago that one of the most selfish things I could do for myself was to drop in the service. In other words, it was selfish to be selfless. And that was cool. That worked for me. Yeah, that was a good doorway. So that's basically what I, in a sense, encourage you to play around with this week, to observe the movement of these three systems, to watch how they, you know, rise or fall in terms of suffering, and play around with gratitude, peace, and love, you know, as an orientation to and as an antidote to suffering in any one of these three systems. And to have confidence, really. To appreciate that this is what's happening. This is, you know, we're never aware of the brain itself. We're aware of the ripples that result in the mind. But this is happening inside my mind. These systems are an ancient legacy. If we were to be grounded in the body, the first foundation of mindfulness, we have to be grounded in the brain. These things are operating. Right? But on the other hand, to not lose faith and to not lose confidence that each one of us, as have tens of thousands of others before us, can work with these systems in a way that leads to more and more awakening, more and more happiness, and more contribution to others. Let's sit for a moment and then wrap up. Thank you for your attention and practice. I apologize for going late tonight, and may your brains and my brains and the brains of all beings become ever more awakened. Thank you.